Well, thank you for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be back in Canada. I did a post, as Eric just mentioned, my first postdoc back in the early 90s, 20 years ago, was at McGill. So I have a warm memory of Canada, at least warm. So I actually gave a colloquium in this room, I think, 10 years ago this month. And I remember remarking at the time that I had come from Arizona directly and I had, gained, I guess, 40 degrees of latitude and lost 40 degrees Fahrenheit. At that time, we were just in the throes of the election we had just had in the U.S. And all my jokes were about hanging chads and things. Unfortunately, we just had yet again another election, and this time I won't even make jokes. All right, so anyway, I'd like to talk today about the landscape. And this is something you may have heard a lot about, especially in the popular press. And there have been a lot of implications of this and various applications and altercations, and it's a big topic. And I understand this is the last colloquium of the semester for you. So view all that as the main course of your colloquium buffet. This is the dessert. This is going to be fun. I'm going to talk about something without too many technical details, but it's a kind of exciting topic. And if you think about why it's exciting, you can just go to the godfather of this subject, who's Lenny Susskind, who I think was Amanda's thesis advisor at Stanford years ago. And here's a quote from him. What we've discovered in the last several years, and this is the main point, is that string theory has an incredible diversity, a tremendous number of solutions, and it allows different kinds of environments. A lot of the practitioners of this kind of mathematical theory have been in a state of denial about it. They don't want to recognize it. They want to believe that the universe is an elegant universe, and it's not so elegant. It's different over here, it's that over there, it's a Rube Goldberg machine over here. And this has created a sort of sense of denial about the facts of the theory. And then very provocatively, the theory is going to win, and the physicists who are trying to deny what's going on are going to lose. So I thought, this is the perfect topic for a colloquium. But as I thought further about it, I realized maybe not. Because after all, although we don't talk about it very much, there are certain rules for giving a good physics colloquium. Number one, physicists or scientists, you should show lots of data from expensive experiments using the latest cutting-edge technologies. Not going to happen. Physicists are conservative, stick to the facts and avoid unnecessary speculation. No, not going to happen here either. Physicists are logical, adhere to a straight logical line with each result building on the previous one. Mm-mm. Physicists are objectivists. We deal in universal truths and fundamental laws. There's no room for the personal opinions, much less the biases of the speaker. All right, the next one, before I say it, I hope nobody here is not a physicist. If you are, you can't say anything now, but, well... And what we mean by this, because everything's relative, and I'm going to violate this one too. And then finally, physicists are only human. Like everyone else, we like a good conclusion, a firm punchline, and a tidy final lesson to take away. A big box with a title, it's all very pretty. And unfortunately, that's not this colloquium. What I'm going to be talking about today are things like this. Can the ground state of a theory be completely irrelevant to that theory? Are we deluding ourselves by always focusing on the vacuum of a theory? What is the boundary between an explanation and an observation? How can we judge when a theory is natural? How can we judge whether one theory is more natural than another? I mean, we say things like this all the time, but we really don't know what we mean. What does it mean for a theory to be predictive or falsifiable? What kinds of numbers should a fundamental theory of physics be capable of predicting? The mass of the electron? Well, you would say yes. The radius of the Earth's orbit around the sun? Well, that's more complicated. People used to think yes, now we're not so sure. Well, we know no. Price of tea in China? Don't laugh. I got a paper once to referee from the Canadian Journal of Physics, which predicted all three of these at once. And even still, I rejected it. What tools are we allowed to use in formulating a scientific theory? The results of experiments, certainly. Theoretical expectations, maybe. Our own existence. Are we once again destined to be the center of the universe, something we thought we gave up a long time ago? To what extent can one meaningfully talk about alternative universes? Are all possible universes created equal? Is the number of allowed possible universes finite or infinite? Is this knowable? Does it matter? Is theoretical particle physics destined to become a branch of cosmology? And I'll explain how I get to this question in a few slides. So if you think about it, this doesn't sound like physics. This sounds like something much worse. The philosophy of physics, or the sociology of physics, or the first steps on that slippery path to socialized science. But the point is that we're currently in the throes of a potentially huge paradigm shift, I think. And what I'm going to try to do here is explain what this is and where it came from in very general terms. So this should be fun, I hope. And my point right now to tell you is there's no tidy outcome. I'm not going to be able to tell you what the end result is. I'll just try to convey the sense of excitement and frustration that many in the string community are currently facing. So let me just explain what I'm going to be doing. First, I'm going to remind you of some very standard particle physics, and then I'll remind you of some beyond the standard particle physics, and then I'll introduce the landscape. Then I'll discuss some sample explorations of the landscape, just to give you a feeling for the kinds of things people do. And then I'll get quickly into the social science with some cautionary tales. For example, it's not so easy to know what you mean when you say you want to count something, or that not all vacua are vacua, or that natural and unnatural are very not easy things to define, or that string theory may or may not be predictive, and it's not really clear what you mean by that. And there's something called the A word, which I will get to eventually, and we'll discuss that one too. And then finally, we'll have a brief overview, and then you can have an audience free-for-all, and I will try to end on time. We'll see. I've got lots of slides. I'm going to zigzag my way through them. If you want to see them later, they can be posted somewhere, but I'm going to be rushing, kind of. So the standard model. Okay, that's what we call the best of our particle physics knowledge to date. I'm going to start skipping slides right here. You've probably seen this a million times. At the electron volt scale, it's nuclei and electrons. At the MeV scale, it's neutrons and protons and electrons. And the GeV scale, it's up quarks and down quarks and electrons. And lots of other kinds of quarks. Strange, charm, top, bottom, three generations of neutrinos and leptons as well. Electron, muon, tau, and their neutrinos. You've seen this. Yes? Good enough. Okay. Beyond this, we don't know. This is as far as we've ever gotten. So what we have is encapsulated in what we call the standard model. So here are the particles. There are three generations, this is what we mean by generations, of quarks and leptons. They're grouped in three groups, up, down, strange, charm, top, bottom. And the leptons, light particles, lepto, light, neutrinos, and their associated leptons. Electron and its neutrino, the muon, its neutrino, the tau and its neutrino. These are the particles of the standard model, the nouns, if you will, of the grammar of the standard model. And then there are the verbs, the forces. So they come in three groups. There's the strong color force, the weak force, and the hypercharge force. And they have different mathematical names which describe the symmetry groups. These are Lie groups that describe the symmetry groups of these forces. And I really just want to introduce the names. So this is called a U1, and this is SU2. It's more complex. It's not abelian. And SU3. This is the strong color force. For each one, I'll tell you how strong it is by giving you what's called analogously the fine structure constant, as you would say for E and M. So this is the fine structure constant for the strong force. It's 1/8. A lot bigger than the E and M one, which is about 1 over 127 or 1 over 137. So that's why it's so strong. Here's the fine structure constant for the weak force, it's 1/30th. And for the hypercharge force, it's 1/59th. These are the three forces that exist in nature. So we say the symmetry group of the standard model is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. Okay? That just means there's a kind of force associated with each one, and they don't really talk to each other. That's what I mean by tensor product, or just take a, you know, this, cross that, there's that, different pieces. And you might wonder about E and M. It's a force you've heard of, you don't see it here. Well, that's because E and M is really just a combination of the SU2 weak force and the U1 hypercharge force. If you wish, this is like blue paint and this yellow paint, and E and M is just green. And the particle that does the mixing is called the Higgs, so if you want, that's an adverb. That's the standard model. But there's lots of reasons to think that there should be something deeper beyond the standard model. And this has been the obsession of particle physicists ever since we had the standard model, which is now about 30 years, 40 years almost. Standard model contains many arbitrary parameters, the masses of all those particles, how much they mix, and all this has to be fit to data rather than explained. Not a good situation. There are many conceptual questions. Why are there three generations and not four, two, eight, eight and a half? Why are there three kinds of forces and not 17? Why do these forces have different strengths and ranges? A fundamental theory, you would think, should explain these things. And then there's another force I haven't even talked about, gravity. How do we incorporate the gravitational force? How do we quantize gravity and put it into the standard model? Again, we expect there should be a deeper principle, as there always was, that we saw over and over again getting to the standard model over the past century, but we don't know what it is. And this is kind of going to be very important because we think that this theory is going to be completely revised into a new, more fundamental theory very soon. And the reason we think this is because the next generation of accelerators and detectors are really coming online right now. And you probably have seen There's the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. This is a huge underground collider. It is operating now. It is taking data magnificently, lower energy than we thought, but a lot of luminosity. And it's going to blow the whole field away into something fantastic and new. This is the Atlas detector, which is one of the detectors at CERN. And there's also Fermilab, which is really hitting strides right now, which were unbelieved to be possible even just a few years ago. So data is coming from both sides now. It's really amazing. So the question is, what do we think is going to happen? What do we think we're going to see? And there are two popular sets of ideas for going beyond the Standard Model that people have come up with in the past 30 years. One is called supersymmetry. And I'm just trying to introduce the main ideas right now, so this is all very cartoonish. The basic idea is that for every boson, which has an integer spin, there's a corresponding fermion with a half-integer spin. I'm going to call that half-integer, even though that's really integer plus a half. One is half an integer. It's two. But I'll call that integer plus a half. So for every boson, there's a fermion and vice versa, which means for all the all the particles we know, quarks, leptons, photons, Ws, Zs, gluons, these are the force carriers of the Standard Model. There's a corresponding squark, or slepton, or photino, wino, xeno, and gluino. These names get laughs by themselves, I see. The S in front is what you do when it's a fermion going to a boson. Eno is what you add when it's a boson going to a fermion. That's the convention. And so there's a lot of new particles, and you wonder, why go through all this trouble? And the reason is that if you did this, it would explain the relative strengths of the forces. It would explain why the strong force is 1/8 and the weak force is 1/29 and so forth. It would explain this process of blue paint, yellow paint making green paint, this process by which E and M pops out of the linear combination of the other two. It has various favorable cosmological implications. It has dark matter candidates. Almost any theory beyond the Standard Model will have a dark matter candidate, but certainly SUSY does. And it provides an answer to a very difficult theoretical puzzle in the Standard Model, which is why the Higgs particle is so light. We do calculations, you expect it to be heavy, but it comes out very light experimentally. So it's a beautiful theory, but it's not observed in nature. So it's got to be broken. And the problem is it's kind of hard to break supersymmetry. We just don't know how to do it. We need a mechanism to spontaneously break supersymmetry. And what we do right now is we don't know how, so we put it in by hand. So we add a lot of new terms into our Lagrangians, and there's lots of more parameters. And the best theory that we have so far is something called the MSSM, and it's got 120 arbitrary parameters, and so that didn't help. The previous problem made it worse. But there are reasons to do this. Another theory, another idea for physics beyond the Standard Model is what we call guts. And the basic idea is to try to realize different forces in particles as different faces or of a single gut force in a single gut particle. As if you had not known that electricity and magnetism, after all, they seem like very different things. Are they different forces? We now know that that's not true. They're really connected. There's something called the electromagnetic force. So you might hope, similarly, that we have strong, weak hypercharge now. Maybe there's a strong, weak hypercharge gut force. In German, that works. So, does that exist? Your first thought would be, can't possibly happen, because remember the fine structure constants, the strengths of the different forces, the SU3, SU2, and U1, are very different. So how can you unify things that have different strengths? But it turns out that in quantum field theory, the strengths of the forces actually depend on the energy scale at which you do the measurement. And these are the values at the energy scales we have accessible today. But if you were to extrapolate up to higher energies, you find your weak force is getting stronger, your strong force is getting weaker, and they do unify. But look at the energy scale, 10 to the 16 of those GeV units that we are currently working at. Right now, our accelerators are going to go to 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 GeV. This is 10 to the 16. This is way beyond what we could ever hope to see directly. But this would be the natural energy scale for grand unification. Guts would be very useful. They would provide new interactions that mix those three forces because they'd be unifying them with the things that mix them into one big block. They would permit rare decays of particles. For example, the proton, which is currently stable in the Standard Model, would decay and have a very long lifetime. And it would explain how all those different charges and interactions of those Standard Model fit together like pieces in a puzzle. But there are many different kinds of guts. There are larger symmetry groups that define the gut. Is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 going to be embedded into a bigger group called SU5 or SO10 or E6? These are different bigger Lie groups. And how would they join together if we even knew what the group was? And what kind of interactions would be allowed once you have these different groups? So again, we have unsolved problems. So these are very exciting and compelling ideas. And theorists are still trying to work on all these things. How do we build realistic Susie guts, Susie theories, gut theories? How do we make... And that's not all there is. There are other ideas as well. There are alternative Higgs structures that people work on. There are large extra space-time dimensions. These are possibilities people talk about. That was my last colloquium 10 years ago, which, of course, you all remember. And then there's strongly coupled kinds of scenarios as well. And then, of course, there's gravity still. How do we incorporate that? So we still are looking for some deeper principle. And most people think that string theory should provide that. So what's string theory? Here's the very deceptively simple premise that an elementary particle, like an electron, if it could be looked at under some sort of Planck scale magnifying glass, you would see some sort of vibrating string. That's the idea. All right, I'm really simplifying. But this idea alone has great power because a different closed loop like this could have different vibrational modes, and those look like different kinds of spin particles. And so this mode of oscillation looks like quarks and leptons. This mode of oscillation looks like W and Z and gluon particles. These are the force carriers. These are the particles they act on. And then there are higher modes, like this one, which might correspond to a spin 2 particle and could correspond to gravity, quantum gravity. So now you've incorporated everything together. So the basic idea is that all the gauge interactions, this means all of the forces we know about, the particles and gravity, would all be unified as different excitations of one fundamental entity. All right, that's a cartoon. String theory is much more sophisticated than just this kind of picture, but that captures at least the basic idea. So the physics of points becomes the physics of strings. And as a point sweeps out through space, a world line, now it sweeps out a two-dimensional world sheet. And the physics of Feynman diagrams gets all puffy, and it becomes the physics of two-dimensional manifolds, and it becomes a theory of very interesting geometric structures. Now, all these pictures were closed strings, but really strings can also be open, and their endpoints can live on membrane-like surfaces of various dimensionalities called D-brains. You've probably heard these kinds of words out there. And these D-brains can intersect each other, and they have strings stretching between them, and the strings of the D-brains can wrap around compactified dimensions. So there's a lot of different geometric configurations. I just want you to understand that it's a very interesting, tightly constrained mathematical structure, but there are lots of possibilities. And so all of those features have profound implications for the allowed excitations of the fundamental strings in brains, and therefore they tightly constrain the low energy predictions, the spectrum of the particles that come out of that theory. So once you choose all these sorts of parameters, you have chosen the particles predicted by the string theory. So this is clearly a whole new language for doing physics, but because string theory also includes gravity, and gravity is very weak, the fundamental energy scale for string theory is very high. It's the Planck scale, which is the quantity you form from G Newton and H bar C. And there it is, 10 to the 19 GeV, three orders of magnitude beyond the guts. So string theory is ultimately a theory of Planck scale physics. So the standard picture is we have the standard model down here, and then we have three forces which are getting stronger and weaker, and they unify eventually up here at the gut scale. And gravity is coming down and getting even stronger and stronger. This is inverse strength, so it's weak, but it gets stronger and stronger. And everything unifies into some sort of string theory, and that's it. That's the highest energy scale we can really talk about. So string theory sits at the highest possible energy scale that we can consider, and at the very least, its low energy predictions, going backwards down towards lower energies, those predictions should be in agreement with the standard model down here. And the hope is that string theory would be able to, in so doing, provide theoretical guidance concerning the different extensions to the standard model as we try to go up. That's what we're trying to do from string theory. Understand the highest energies and work down and connect to the standard model at the bottom. And over the past 25 years, I think it's fair to say that string theory has come to occupy a central place in high energy physics, at least theoretical high energy physics. It's had a profound impact in many branches of theoretical physics and mathematics, and it's led to many new ideas and insights concerning the structure of field theory, gauge theory, supersymmetry, and their relations to gravity. If it did nothing more than that, string theory would be a major success story in theoretical physics, and it already is. And it's even been called a piece of 21st century physics that fell by chance to the 20th century. This is the god of string theory, Ed Witten, and you may have seen pictures of him. There he is. And so my point in this slide is to say string theory works. It has many successes. I'm going to take it as a given for the rest of this talk. Now, you can argue that maybe it's not the right theory. That's fine. Let's assume it is and go on. So the question is, how many string theories are there? Is the theory unique? And this is where the problem is. Because it turns out that string theory gives rise to a multitude of self-consistent vacua. So each one of these is called a different string vacuum, or if you will, a different string model. And I'll use the words interchangeably. But it's like having a big master equation, which has many possible solutions. And each solution predicts a whole different kind of universe, a whole different kind of properties. And roughly speaking, each of these different string vacua corresponds to different ways of compactifying the theory from 10 dimensions to 4 dimensions. String theory actually lives in 10 dimensions. It predicts their extra dimensions. And 6 of them are unseen, obviously, because we live in 4 dimensions. Length, width, height, and time. That's the 4. String theory says there should be 10. So there are 6 others that are curled up, wrapped up in some way, and there are so many ways to curl things and wrap things with the brains, and they can wrap around and such. There are so many ways to do this, and each of those gives rise to a very different way of compactifying, different choices of what surfaces and the kinds of fluxes that can go through them and all sorts of things. So there are many ways to do this. Now, it has been known that there are many ways to do this ever since the mid-1980s. This is not news. However, by and large, string theorists really didn't worry about this. And the reason they didn't worry about this, there are two reasons. One, these string models had what are called flat directions, which is just a fancy way of saying there were no dynamical ways of fixing many of the continuous parameters that could be freely adjusted, like the strength of a coupling constant. Should it be a little bigger than that? There was no dynamical thing that selected it. It was, if you imagine, a potential which would prefer having a minimum at the preferred value of the coupling constant, well, what I'm saying is to such a potential, if it were to exist, was flat. I mean, he didn't care where it was. That's why we call it a flat direction. There were all these there were no dynamical ways of fixing continuous parameters. It turns out flat directions are in direct conflict with experiment because they correspond to extra unobserved massless particles and unseen forces. So this was already a problem that was considered to be more urgent. And another problem that was more urgent is that these models were usually supersymmetric, the ones that people were studying, and yet the real world, as I told you, is non-supersymmetric, so that was also a pressing problem. And then there was a final major problem. The models people talked about were usually formulated in flat space or anti-de Sitter space, which is negative cosmological constant, which is not what we know now exists. We live in positive cosmological constant, de Sitter, not anti-de Sitter. So this is also not realistic. So what people tacitly said to themselves, it was, well, some sort of vacuum selection mechanism, some way of all these different choices for compactifying, there's going to be some mechanism which selects the true one. It would be found. Probably it would be selected by some non-perturbative aspect of string theory, something we don't quite understand. And that this stabilization mechanism would also lead to a unique vacuum that would solve these other problems. It would break supersymmetry and introduce the Sitter space. So it was believed that fixing these problems, if we ever learned how to do it, would also uniquely fix a vacuum. And so they didn't worry. That was more or less, I think, the belief. So what changed? Well, starting over the past decade, and especially since 2003, there's been an increasing realization that this is not what's going to happen. In the mid-1990s, we gained considerable insight into the non-perturbative behavior of these theories. We actually cracked some parts of the puzzle, and we discovered that they continue to be self-consistent even when these parameters are left unfixed, even at strong coupling. So the non-perturbative physics did not lift that degeneracy. That was kind of an unfortunate result. Also in 2003, various proposals suggested the existence of controlled methods of stabilizing vacua, breaking supersymmetry, and realizing de Sitter space in string theory. We now think we have a handle on all those problems. So both of these are very exciting technical advances in string theory, major work in the past decade. Very exciting, but unfortunately, from this perspective, they did not lead to a vacuum selection principle. Quite the contrary, they showed that a plethora of self-consistent string compactifications is likely to continue to exist even after vacuum stabilization and other problems are solved. So we're faced now with this problem all by itself. So what has resulted then is the realization that string theory really does contain an infinite multitude of solutions, a multitude of stable ground states without a dynamical or symmetry argument to select amongst them. So such ground states or such vacua can be viewed, if you will, as the local minima in a complex theoretical terrain of hills and valleys, and people often show a picture like that. This would be a flat direction, if you will. This is often called the string theory landscape. Now, in Arizona, we don't see things like that. No flat directions at all. And if you go and count the different cacti, which each one corresponds to a different possible self-consistent solution, and people have counted, how many self-consistent points are there, local minima, do we expect? You get a number which is 10 to the 500. Approximately, give or take a few zillions. So, well, 10 to the 500, I think, is an abuse of scientific notation. Because you got a hundreds already in the exponent. I'm going to show you what 10 to the 500 really is. That's 10 to the 500. Now, I had graphics, which animation for this slide, which was really great, but it's not working. So there they all are. I was going to plop them in groups, and, well, that was very impressive. But anyway, sorry. This is still pretty darn big. Let me point out to you again, just to emphasize, if you are missing one little zero there, you have lost 90% of it. That's what a tenth, I mean, it blows your mind. That's 10 to the 500. So you might hope, doesn't matter how big it is, how many solutions there are, but it does matter, because the low energy phenomenology that emerges from the string depends critically on the particular choice of which of those 10 to the 500. All the things you want to know about, why is the gauge group SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, or SO5, or SU5, or SO10, why are there three generations of particles and not four or five or 17? What is the scale for Suzy breaking if there is Suzy? What is the value of the cosmological constant? All this depends on the particular one of those 10 to the 500 you pick. So how do you make progress in the absence of a vacuum selection principle? Well, there was a very important paper by Mike Douglas in 2003 who said, look, maybe we'll examine the landscape statistically. We'll look for correlations between different low energy properties that would otherwise be unrelated in field theory without string theory. Maybe the number of generations is connected somehow to the gauge group, SU3 versus SU2 versus U1 or something. In our normal non-string language, those are independent things you can pick or choose. Maybe string theory ties them together statistically on the landscape. If you could do that, then this would provide a new method for extracting phenomenological predictions from string theory independently of a vacuum selection principle. And this idea has triggered a surge of activity examining the statistical properties of the landscape. And people have looked at relations between all of these different things. How often do you get the standard model gauge group, the numbers of chiral generators, all this. And lots of people have been doing it. Moreover, this line of attack has even led to various paradigm shifts. And I'll talk about some of these. For example, alternative notions of naturalness. What does it mean to be natural anymore? Well, on a landscape, it could mean different things. There are new cosmological or inflationary scenarios, anthropic arguments, field theory, and so forth. There's a lot of work now. People are asking very fundamental questions about what we mean when we said predict something. How do we extract a prediction from this kind of scenario? So there's been a lot of work. And there's even something called the String Vacuum Project, which I'm part of, which is a large multi-year, multi-institution, interdisciplinary. These, by the way, are the three adjectives you have to have in any grant proposal. Collaboration, to explore the space. Ooh. I work at the National Science Foundation now. I can't say things like that. That was a joke. Oh, now they think I'm even more serious. Forget it. All right. The idea is to explore the space of string vacua, compactifications, and their low energy implications through enumeration and classification of these, detailed analysis of those which have realistic low energy phenomenologies, and statistical studies across the landscape as a whole. And the idea is that this will involve intense research at the intersection of particle physics, mathematics, and computer science. And we actually have meetings where all these different kinds of people come together. So the particle physics people that started this, here we are, that's me, but there are others. You may recognize some of the names. So we are actively trying to make headway in thinking about landscape very seriously. But unfortunately, although there have been many abstract theoretical discussions of the landscape, there have been very few direct statistical examinations of actual string vacua, string models. And the reason is because this is very hard. Even just to work out the consequences of one choice can take you hours. It's not simple. It's a very complicated affair. String theory is a very subtle subject. And most of the effort over the past few years is focused on the landscape of open strings. So what I was involved in over the past few years has been to perform the first ever statistical studies of the heterotic or closed string landscape. So that's my baby. That's my corner of the landscape. And I think this is important because heterotic models, these closed models, are very different from the type 1 models, open strings. Open strings and closed strings have very different properties. In particular, I like the heterotic ones better because they have tighter constraints, mathematically speaking. Their gauge groups, their symmetries come out very differently, and they have nice properties, like those different coupling constants unifying to make a gut. That happens naturally in these heterotic models. And so you could expect very different kinds of physics from these. So I just want to give you a taste of what we're doing. Other people who are doing OpenStrings, it's very similar. We make a lot of computer code. So I have a computer program, or my graduate students do, and what they do is they put in how many supersymmetries we want, and there's some random number generator, and we say how long we want the program to run, and it runs and it pops out things like this, and this tells us about how we wrap all those different degrees of freedom, and we compactify those dimensions and wrap the brains and do all this, and we can do this very easily. And then we take one of those choices and we analyze it. So the first thing we do is we look for how many supersymmetries there are, and then we look at how many different kinds of photons and things, and we know what force carriers there are, so then we know what forces there are. And then we look at the rest of the spectrum, the allowed string excitations, and we classify them, and we group them into multiplets, and they come out this way. We can quote everything we need to quote, and these are the predictions of the string. And computers can do it. And what do we find? I just want to show you a few random results. I have a lot more here, but I'm looking at the clock and I want to get to the sociology stuff. So here's, for example, the kinds of things you can say. 10% of your models have an SU3, but 95% of them have an SU2, and likewise a U1. So SU3 seems harder to do than the others. Okay. You could ask about different kinds of gauge groups. What comes out, these symmetries? Well, 23 of them percent have SU3 factors of the different gauge groups. Remember, 10% of the models have SU3s, 23% of the gauge groups have SU3s. Okay, so what you learn from that is something interesting. Although SU3 color-like symmetries appear in 24% of the gauge groups, those groups themselves emerge from actual string models in our sample only half as frequently as you would have expected. Okay, little things like this, believe me, this is a game you can play, and it's important, and you find some correlations. 99.81% of all heterotic string models, which contain one or more SUN factors, also exhibit an equal or greater number of U1 factors. You know, what's interesting, you find things like this. This is a great hypothesis generator. You find things like this, and then you go mathematically and you prove it, that it had to be so. But you wouldn't have thought to even ask the question if you weren't doing this. So studies of the landscape have taught us a lot about string theory. Okay, how often do SU3, SU2, and U1 appear simultaneously? In other words, you would have a weak kind of force, a color kind of force, and a hypercharge kind of force, just like the standard model does, simultaneously. Okay, it turns out to happen 10%. So that's how likely you are to get the right kinds of forces out of a random string model, a random place. Okay, are there correlations between different gauge groups? Yeah. You want to know what percentage of your model will have an SU2 simultaneously with an SU5? Well, here's what percentage of the models, and so forth. And you can study these things and learn a lot. For example, some things just can't happen. And then you go and prove it. And sometimes you can't prove it, but yet you see it. So there's all sorts of interesting things you can learn about this. Are we making predictions? Well, we'll discuss in a minute. But you can learn a lot about string theory this way. Okay, I want to skip quickly. You can look at the cosmological constant. How likely is it to get a really tiny positive value? Well, here's a histogram. Imagine a histogram of cosmological constants. This is what we do. Well, what you'll notice is that you can get in string theory both positive and negative values. 73% of these values are positive, but I got to warn you, this is not the cosmological constant. It's negative is, little lambda. So negative lambda, so anti de Sitter. So 73% of the time it's wrong. 27% of the time it's right. Then you would ask, well, what kinds of values are you getting? An interesting thing we discovered is that there's a great redundancy in the values of the cosmological constant. Something very strange. Here's a theory of the world which has these particles and these forces. Here's another theory of the world which has completely different particles and forces. No relation, and yet they have identical cosmological constants, one-loop vacuum energies. Why? But it's huge. This is on numbers of thousands, and you see what's going on here. The number of values of the cosmological constant is significantly less than the number of models examined. And what that means is that it looks like it's even saturating. Maybe there's only a finite number of cosmological constants the universe can even have. String theory would tell you this if this is true. We did a fit. Who knows? This is all sorts of new uncharted territory. This is the landscape. All right, are there correlations between cosmological constants and gauge groups? There shouldn't be in any non-stringy theory. Turns out there's a beautiful one in string theory. The more broken your gauge group is, you break it from something big like SO10, a unified group, down to SU5, down to SU3 cross SU2 cross SU, the more you break it, the smaller your cosmological constant gets as well. Unbelievable. This is important because only string theory could even tell you whether anything like this is true or not. This is gauge groups. This means the strong, weak, hypercharge. This is gravity. These things are not connected except in any theory but string theory. Yet we're finding all this wonderful stuff. Okay, skip, 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 skip. Again, I'll make my point. I think it's incredible that string theory allows such calculations to be done. These are literally statistical calculations regarding probabilities that one set of laws and fundamental constants for the universe are favored over another. On the other hand, there are numerous subtleties that emerge when trying to perform analyses of this type, and new methods need to be developed in order to extract phenomenological predictions in a meaningful way. So I'll give you one example, the problem of floating correlations. This is something we ran into when we started to really do these systematic studies. Mike Lennick is my graduate student, former graduate student. He is now a postdoc at McMaster in Canada as well. So you see, Canada's, a lot of us are cycling through Canada. We're very happy to. And you guys, well, you know what a great department you are. All right. So what is this? This is the problem that, or the observation, that some statistical correlations are unstable. They float or evolve as the sample size increases. You get a percentage of something, but the longer you look and the farther you go, the percentage starts to shift. And it's not just numerical error, it really is shifting. Why? Here's why. Essentially, as you continue to randomly generate models, it gets harder and harder to find new ones that you didn't already see. Therefore, the physical characteristics of things that were originally rare are forced, often, to become less rare as the sample size increases and as you probe more deeply into the space of models. Does that make sense? If you've seen things before, then they become ordinary now. They're not the things you want to see new. But the new things are new by definition. So as you keep going, each time you find something new, it is more rare. It is easy to find the first gold nugget in a field that hasn't been prospected. But at the end, when after everybody's been through, if you find a gold nugget, it's very hard to do that. So the percentage of gold nuggets found per day drops. Okay? That's one way to say it. Here's another way to say it. You don't really get to look through the space of models. What you really have to do is use some model construction technique which specifies models according to some set of internal parameters. All those things like how you compactify all that. These are the different parameters. You randomly choose your set of parameters here. But the mapping to the actual models is not one-to-one. So certain models you find a lot. They come up again and again. And your computer generates it again. And you say, all right, I saw you before. I'm not counting you anymore. Go away. But A keeps popping up. Then C pops up a lot. But you don't know whether you're ever going to find B. This is the hard thing. So if B has the random thing, the rare thing, eventually as you keep looking, the only time you're ever going to find a new model that you're going to change your data collection bag that you're going to put in your bag is the new model B. And so eventually the rare stuff starts appearing more and more. Let me put it, so what that means is you don't see the model space directly. You see a distorted version of it depending on how you're probing. And this is what you are allowed to see. This is what you really want to understand. Does this difference matter for the statistical correlations between physical observables? Yes, if the physical properties are somehow correlated with those probability deformations. To give you an example, all right, I never did get over it, so. It's the difference between this. This is 2000, not 2010 or 8. And that. This is based on land area. That's the map. I apologize for the white area. But we did it to Hawaii, too, in Alaska, so. This is a cartogram based on population. That means you scale up everything according to the size of the state. California gets it. Now you understand why it was a close election. It doesn't look so close here. Or even population density. That's the District of Columbia, I think. Maybe. Anyway, okay. These things do matter and can affect your outcomes. So there are ways to get around this. I just want to illustrate this in a slightly different way. So what you need is a way of extracting information, even if it's only limited, about the full landscape on the basis of only partial information. A lot of gauge theorists have to try to find ways to make do with their numerical codes and try to extract the real universe. We have a similar set of problems here. Let me give you an example slightly differently. It's like plucking balls from an urn. You randomly try to generate a string model. It's like reaching into a big bag where there's a lot of balls of different colors. Let's say an urn contains 300,000 balls of different colors. One-third of the balls are red. You seek to know what fraction of the balls in the urn are red, and you try to determine this by choosing a ball randomly from the urn. You look at its color. You mark it so you'll know you saw it before. You put a little line on it. Throw it back in the bag. Now, that would be the stupid step, but that's how our computers have to be. That's the analog of what the computers are doing. So you put it back in the step. You mix again, and then repeat. And in this way, you hope to get the fraction that's red. Well, what will happen? Well, we actually ran a simulation just to prove something. If all balls are treated equally, no bias, approximately one-third of all balls selected will be red, and this will not vary significantly with sample size. The longer you do this, it'll keep being about a third. But this is not the proper analogy. This is. Now imagine that the red balls have a different size than the others, so that the probability of picking a red ball, that's model B, hard to reach, from the urn on a given try is gamma times the probability of picking any other small. So gamma could be like one-tenth here. What fraction of the selected balls will be red? This floats with the sample size. This is my explanation of why things float. Imagine, for example, that gamma is one-fifth. Then at the beginning, only one-fifteenth of your balls are going to be red. But pretty soon, you've seen every other ball. So at the end, the only time you're ever seeing a new ball is on the rare occasion you pluck out a red one. So all the ones that you're seeing at the end that were new are red, all of them. So the probability is floating up to the one-third value, but it only emerges at the end. That's why things are floating, because not everything is equally weighted. But suppose in the landscape we don't have enough time or ability to wait that long, and we don't know the number gamma, then how do you make progress? This is the question. There are methods we've developed. They work beautifully. They give you the right answers very quickly. I have no time to get into it, but it's possible. In fact, the true computational situation we face in the landscape is even worse, because there can be a whole spectrum of different sizes, meaning intrinsic probabilities for the different balls or string models, and there's no guarantee that the sizes or the probabilities of the balls or models are in any way correlated with their colors or physical characteristics. So if you will, to use some particle physics words, there could be a huge CKM matrix between colors and sizes, all of whose entries are essentially unknown. So you need methods of extracting meaningful statistical information, even for such general situations. So we've actually written some statistics papers just to understand how to do this kind of work. The point is we're taking it seriously. Okay, here's another complication. All the previous discussions assume that the low energy limit of a given string model has a relatively simple field theory structure, non-stringy ordinary particle physics, a single vacuum and a tower of excitations on that vacuum. And so the resulting phenomenology associated with each string model is uniquely determined. You just look at what comes out, the vacuum structure and all the excitations, and each string model corresponds to a unique possible ground state for the universe. You could be in that string model or that one. In other words, one string model corresponds to one vacuum, and counting models means counting vacua. That's been the assumption. Even that's wrong. In recent years, there's been an increasing recognition that many models contain additional metastable vacua, whose lifetimes, even though they're metastable, they have lifetimes for decay, but the lifetimes can easily exceed cosmological timescales. They're just as good as real vacua. In other words, you don't always have to live in the true vacuum. You could be caught in a metastable vacua, any of a metastable vacuum. And these should therefore be counted as two possible states for the universe from one string model. Not just this, but even that. And moreover, the phenomenological properties of the metastable vacuum can be completely different from those of the true ground state. This one might have Suzy preserved, that one might have Suzy broken. Everything would be different. So the one-to-one connection between models and vacua need not apply. So the full landscape can be even worse than you thought it was. 10 to the 500 may not even be correct. And in fact, this effect can be particularly dramatic. It's a slightly technical slide, but the point of it is clear. This could completely alter our perspective on the sorts of physics which might dominate the landscape. Why? Because many string vacua take the form, okay, this is just for the experts, of what are called flux compactifications. And these theories have deconstructed low-energy versions, these are just words, which correspond to different charges, different particles, this is just what often comes out. My point is, when you add in something called kinetic mixing, invented here, by the way, where's Bob? very important idea in particle physics. Bob Holden developed it. But if you put that into this theory, then it's recently been shown that these theories give rise to infinite towers of metastable vacua with higher and higher energies, not just one or two, but an infinite tower of them. Ground state, next one. So each of these little bottom humps here is a different metastable vacuum. Infinite towers all the way up. String theories prefer to do this. So imagine, even if there was just one model that did this, well, even if that model is relatively rare, just one, the fact that it gives rise to an infinitely many vacuum means that it completely dominates the property of the landscape as a whole, just by being infinite towers. Okay, the existence of the landscape also allows you to reformulate many of your usual theoretical notions in hitherto unimaginable ways. For example, let's ask a simple question. Is Susie natural? Is supersymmetry natural? Well, it's an important question because most theoretical frameworks for physics beyond the Standard Model involve the introduction of supersymmetry. For good reasons, it solves all these problems, as we talked about. So supersymmetry is truly ubiquitous in all the theories we write down, on the archive, if you look at all the papers, and our colloquium presentations, everywhere except the data so far. But lots of competing theories have recently appeared past decade. Large extra dimensions, small extra dimensions, strongly coupled scenarios, etc. And the theories built around all these ideas have gotten more and more complex. Nowadays, you go to a physics conference on Beyond the Standard Model Physics model building, and you hear people say, well, of course, we start with our world. We're made of open strings, and here's my model. We live on a brain, and the brain lives in extra dimensions, and the brain is wrapped, and it intersects other brains, and the extra dimensions are warped, and the warping is severe and forms a throat, and the brain is falling into the throat, etc. I'm serious. Amanda knows that I'm right. This is what people talk about. This may sound like cutting-edge model building, maybe to some, but it sounds like a lot to swallow. I'm not making fun. I have done this myself. I'm guilty. It may seem highly unnatural, but is supersymmetry the alternative to all this? Is that itself truly natural? What does it mean to be natural anyway? There are lots of different notions of naturalness. For example, there's something called Dirac naturalness, or effective field theory Dirac. A theory is natural if the dimensionless coefficients of operators are order one, no small numbers, basically. Or there's another refinement of that called Tuff naturalness. Even if a number is small, it can be natural if that smallness is protected by a symmetry, like the photon mass. It's exactly zero, as far as we know. Is that unnatural? No, because there's a symmetry, gauge invariance, that forces it to be. But neither of these addresses the question as to whether a theory, even if it's natural in this sense, is likely to be right. And that's what we meant. How likely is Susie to be the correct theory? Well, you don't often use a word like likely, because even though we constantly judge theories in this way when we are drinking beer, we don't say it aloud because the question seems more philosophical than scientific. Likely relative to what? To all of the theories you can imagine? Who's doing the imagining? I mean, you get different answers. So how can you compare the likelihood of one theory against another? Well, string theory, of course, does it all, provides a framework in which this question can be addressed in a meaningful way because of the landscape. You can reformulate the question. In the landscape of possible string solutions, how many of these solutions are supersymmetric? Is Susie natural on the landscape or relatively rare? Now you can answer it. And this is what you find if you use all the techniques we developed. N equal 1 means one supersymmetry, 2, 4 supersymmetries, no supersymmetries. Very likely. Susie is very rare. Nearly half of the landscape is non-Susian, tachyon-free. In fact, a quarter at most, not even. Really, the expectation is even less. Supersymmetry is unnatural from a string landscape perspective. Is that a problem? Not at all. Maybe you can even consider it good news. It means that if we really discover supersymmetry, this was Gordy Kane's slide, for those of you that get that joke, we actually will learn something about string theory and its preferred compactifications if we discover Susie. Because if it's really rare on the landscape, and yet we discovered experimentally at the LHC, now we've pinpointed which sets of string models might actually be the correct ones. We'll learn something. All right, let me skip. Lots of other things you can do. Skip. Philosophical nature. To what extent is string theory predictive? This is very important. All right, we could have a discussion. You could argue, but there are answers, and there are more, but you started me at 410, so. Quick. But here's the point. The question about predictivity boils down to a single critical question. To what extent are there correlations between different physical observables that hold across the string theory landscape as a whole, right? That's what you mean. The existence of correlations, you'd say, okay, then that predicts that. If there's an absence, then you'd say it's not predictive. Well, unfortunately, the true picture is likely to be something like this. Here's a region where you have a correlation between X and Y. Here's a region where you have a correlation between Y and Z. Here's a region where you have a correlation between W and Z. Well, now you have an overlap region. This implies in this part that now there's a three-way correlation. Here's a different three-way correlation. Here, it's X, Y, W, and Z. So here, there's just two correlations, each with two quantities. Here is a single four, this is just with three little regions. Different regions of the landscape will exhibit different correlations. These regions will have different sizes, and moreover, they're likely to exhibit non-trivial overlaps. So can you make a predictivity measure out of this, a number? Yeah, you can define something. We've done it. The point is, there are ways to do these things. Okay, the final idea. Thus far, we've treated the landscape in a rather simplistic manner. There are many possible states, and the universe chooses one. But of course, from a quantum cosmological standpoint, it's much more likely that all possibilities are realized and that our universe is only one bubble in such a larger multiverse or megaverse. In accordance with the string landscape, each universe in the multiverse would have its own physical laws and its own constants of nature. That is the multiverse. If so, then our own universe is not special at all, and there would be many other parallel universes whose properties need not resemble those of our own universe in any way. You could even further imagine that these different universes are continually being spawned, and there's a process, this was discussed years ago, and it's called eternal inflation, and this is Andre Linde at Stanford, who was one of the main proposers of this whole idea, now realizable very naturally, perhaps, in the landscape. If these ideas are correct, then there are entirely new sets of questions that get spawned as well. Is the number of possible universes that exist today finite or infinite? Is this even knowable? Does it matter? How are they generated? Through vacuum decay and tunneling in the interiors of black holes? Are all possible universes created equal? How did we land in this universe? Are the fundamental laws of physics, as we know them, destined to become nothing more than environmental accidents of initial conditions? We're not used to thinking that way. Are quantities such as the electron-proton mass ratio now going to be viewed as having no deep theoretical underpinnings, but instead like the planetary orbital radii valid just by accident in this solar system, in this universe? In other words, now you understand the question, is theoretical particle physics destined to become a branch of cosmology? How did we wind up here? And the biggest question of them all, indeed, why are we here? Is there anything special about our own universe whatsoever? Any tool that remains by which we can hope to develop insight into why this is the preferred one, if it were? So this brings us to the A word, the anthropic principle, which you might have heard. This is how they often present it. The universe takes the form that it does so as to allow observers to observe it. I find this to be silly. The universe doesn't care about me or you, and it doesn't exhibit narcissistic or exhibitionist tendencies that make it want to be observed. This is not only anthropic, this is anthropomorphic. But here's a version that's not so silly. The Star Trek version. A pop quiz. The Enterprise enters an uncharted solar system with 10 to the 500 planets. In order to survey the planets quickly, Kirk sends down a landing party down to each planet simultaneously. It's a big crew he's got. After an hour, he puts out a general call for survey reports to be sent back up to the ship. Question, what percentage of surveys will report an M-type planet capable of supporting life? What? They were sent down as they are, but you're asking the right question. You're asking an anthropic question. The answer, 100%, because all other teams will be dead and won't be able to file any reports. No, there's a deep principle here. Certain outcomes about the universe are guaranteed because otherwise we couldn't have even asked the question. This is the real serious version of the anthropic principle. In fact, this kind of reasoning was used most successfully to predict the value, not only that it's not zero, the cosmological constant, but actually the value that it has was predicted years ago by Weinberg using just this kind of argument. He said, the cosmological constant can't be too big or else the universe would have expanded too rapidly to allow the formation of structure, galaxies and stars, to condense as needed to generate life. This gives an upper value to lambda. Okay, that's just an upper value. That's not the anthropic principle. It's just an upper value. But the anthropic principle is to say, well, there's no other reason it should be any smaller. So therefore, that must be the size. Okay. If the multiverse is real, then the only hope we may have for understanding the properties of our own universe is through these sorts of applications of the anthropic principle. But there's also fierce opposition to this. People say this is not the way science should be done. The anthropic principle represents, they say, a surrendering of the idea that the fundamental laws of physics are unique and not tuned for particular outcomes, certainly not an outcome such as life. And the anthropic principle, as Bert Richter likes to say, is an explanation, not an observation. These are different things. In science, we normally accept certain priors, inputs, or assumptions, or axioms, and we try to use those to derive new results. But what, is it fair to use our own existence as an input? This is the question. How do we decide which input data are acceptable and which data isn't? Well, and what is the data anyway? Intelligent civilizations? Life in general? What kinds of life can we imagine? Are universes which are capable of supporting life somehow preferred in a Darwinian sense over those that don't? People really look at this. If you try to get carbon, are those things likely to make the universe inflate and therefore occupy a bigger patch of the whole universe and therefore we're more likely to land there? This is the kind of questions people talk about. Obviously, there's no easy answers to these questions. It's just a raging debate. However, I'd like to point out, especially for you, that it is possible to give an existence proof that intelligent and sophisticated civilizations can exist, even thrive, under the most inhospitable external environmental circumstances. Okay, I'm going to end in a few slides. Here we go. Can you test these ideas? Are they even falsifiable? Here's Lenny again. Throughout my long experience as a scientist, I've heard unfalsifiability hurled at so many important ideas that I'm inclined to think that no idea can have great merit unless it has drawn this criticism. He gives some examples, but they're all very interesting. Quarks. You can never see a free quark, so it's not falsifiable. But now we know, of course, the quark theory can be confirmed and falsified. We had an incorrect way of thinking about quarks and how to test them. Here's another example, inflation. How can you ever go back and test inflation? But now we have indirect ways we've developed to test inflation. It took 20 years, but we've done it. Lamarck could say to Darwin, how can you test evolution? It's unfalsifiable. You can't go backwards and do it. But of course, we now know exactly how to test things. And there's evidence for that. As Lenny says, this is a quote from him, good scientific methodology is not an abstract set of rules. It's conditioned by and determined by the science itself and the scientists who create the science. What might have constituted scientific proof for a particle physicist of the 1960s, namely the detection of an isolated particle, we've never seen a quark, not isolated, but we now know that's inappropriate for a modern quark physicist who can never hope to remove an isolated quark. Let's not put the cart before the horse. Science is the horse that pulls the cart of philosophy. Very interesting point. Will it be possible to test eternal inflation in the landscape? I certainly think so, although as it may be in the case of quarks, the tests will be less direct and involve more theory than some would like. All right, and there are ideas on how to do that. Let me conclude. Why go through all this worry? Well, why don't we just focus on our own universe, the fertile patch where we live? Well, you could make this flippant point, and it's real, if you climb mountains, you understand it. But I think it's more likely to say this. If there are really 10 to the 500 factor, then it's very unlikely we'll be able to know which one is our universe ever. Many will satisfy current experimental constraints, so our need to make predictions still requires that we understand something of the more global structure. But even more compellingly, I think, we still want to answer the why questions of the Standard Model. Why three generations? Why three types of non-gravitational forces? If the Standard Model is part of a huge ensemble, then the only way to answer why questions is to understand the distribution of that ensemble. And that, I think, is why we want to be looking at the landscape. So let me just conclude that there are lots of things that we have yet to do to understand the landscape. And there are certain dangers involved of looking at only certain corners of the landscape and thinking you're seeing the whole thing. But I think there's a lot of progress that you nevertheless can make if you had time to read it. So where does this leave us? All right, so remember that quote I had at the beginning? So there's Lenny. The physicists, the theory is going to win, and the physicists who are trying to deny what's going on are going to lose. Well, here's Steinhardt's response. I love Lenny, but I hate this recent landscape idea, and I'm hopeful it'll go away. To which Lenny responds, I want to thank Paul Steinhardt for his concise summary of the views on the other side of this debate. Here's Tuft. Tuft won the Nobel Prize in 1999. When I hear Lenny say the theory is going to win and physicists who are trying to deny it are going to lose, then to my opinion, he's going too far. This is not the way physics has worked for us in the past, and it's not too late to hope that we will be able to find better arguments in the future. He responds, Lenny, that's hard to argue with. I consider myself to be a cautious, rather conservative physicist. I don't know if many people would consider him to be conservative, but I really don't like new ideas, but I also find wisdom in a quote from Sherlock Holmes. When you've eliminated everything else, whatever remains must be the truth, no matter how improbable. Here's a quote from Steve Giddings at Santa Barbara. I feel the views of some that such a picture is unscientific or a cop-out are extreme. In particular, understanding the laws that give rise to the megaverse is a very scientific question and one that I think is well worth studying further. Here's one that I particularly like. This is Shalokin's. Finally, after 15 years, the debate has started that should have started around the mid-80s, but was stifled by irrational opposition against the notion that our observation of the Standard Model could be biased by our own existence. To me, at least one thing seems absolutely obvious. The idea that the Standard Model is even approximately unique will eventually, this is incredible, will eventually find its place in history next to Kepler's attempt to compute the orbits of the solar system, understandable at its time, but terribly anthropocentric. Final quote, and I'm done. Gino Segre. We now believe that we live on an ordinary planet, one of many, circling an ordinary star, one of many, in an ordinary galaxy, one of many. Perhaps we now need to take the next step, admittedly a revolutionary one, of saying that we live in an ordinary universe, a very small part of an enormous megaverse. This would be the ultimate fulfillment of the whole Copernican idea. So with that to chew on, I conclude. Thank you.